Good afternoon. Welcome to the final session of this year's Mind and Life Dialogue. In this session, we'll be talking about the intersection of Buddhism and science. And that session will go from 1 to 2 o'clock. After that, we'll have a closing dialogue from 2 to 2:45. So during the first session, we'll be hearing... So we'll have four presenters talking about the Buddhism-Science Exchange. First, we'll be hearing from Geshe Lakdor, who's the director of the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives, well-known to you. He oversees monastic science initiatives. Next, we'll be hearing from Geshe Lobsang Tenzin Negi, who's professor of practice at Emory University and spiritual director of Drepung Lozling Monastery in Atlanta. Then we'll be hearing from Geshe Dadul Namgyal, who's senior resident teacher at Drepung in Atlanta and distinguished translator now with the Emory Tibet program. And finally, we'll be hearing from Yangti Rinpoche, who's the founding president of Maitripa College in Oregon and the spiritual director of multiple Tibetan Buddhist centers in the United States. So with these distinguished and very active scholars at the interface of science and Buddhism, we'll start with Geshe Lakdor. And each one will take 15 minutes.
With obeisance to His Holiness the Dalai Lama and all the reverend teachers, and my humble respect to all the distinguished scholars and everybody present here, the topic of our talk is related to the exchange of ideas between Buddhism and Western culture and the science initiatives, both of which are very actively done in the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives. But to save time, I really would like to show a 10-minute video so that you get a feel about the library who is doing all these activities, rather than my trying to say a lot of things which will lead to a lot of digression. And after that, I will, as a form of conclusion, speak 2-3 sentences and then I'll conclude.
Sound here, right?
Sound.
In the early years of exile, following the communist Chinese takeover of Tibet in 1959, refugees escaping to India carried hundreds of manuscripts and other sacred objects out of Tibet. On the arduous journey across the Himalayas, these precious objects and texts were often guarded above all else. Once safe in India, many of these sacred manuscripts were offered to His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Realizing the impending threat and precariousness of the situation, His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama, among other endeavors, conceived of and founded the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives to restore, protect, preserve, and promote the Tibetan culture. The cornerstone for the library's impressive Tibetan-style building was laid on 11th June 1970 in the hill station of Dharamsala, northern India, the heart of the exiled Tibetan community. In November the following year, the library opened its doors for the first time, growing to become one of the most important and premier institutions in the world dedicated to the preservation and dissemination of Tibetan culture. To this day, Tibetans circumambulate the library day and night in reverence of the sacred objects and texts housed within.
This institute, Library of Tibetan Works and Archives, is established based on the vision of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. The main objective of this institute is to preserve the unique Tibetan cultural heritage
which is not only a world cultural heritage, but which is a compassionate and nonviolent culture. But unfortunately, this very important culture is facing threat of extinction in its own country, Tibet. So therefore, by preserving this culture, we'll not only be able to preserve the Tibetan identity, but we strongly believe that we'll also be able to make contribution for peace and harmony in the rest of the world.
The primary objectives of the library are to provide a comprehensive cultural resource center and to promote an environment that encourages research and an exchange of knowledge between scholars and students. These factors are of the utmost importance in a contemporary world shaped by political and spiritual confusion. In 1991, the Institute was recognized as Center for Tibetan Studies by Himachal Pradesh University. In 1996, the Tibetan Parliament in Exile accorded the library the combined status of National Library, National Museum, and National Archives. On 3rd September 2003, the National Manuscripts Mission, an initiative of the Government of India, appointed the library as one of the National Manuscript Resource Centers. Having begun its life with humble collections of manuscripts and books in Tibetan and English, the library is now a repository for significant collections of artifacts, manuscripts, and other records, while also serving as a center for language and cultural education. It now houses 10 full-fledged departments, which include the administration, 2 significant libraries, a museum, audiovisual archives, research and translation department, cultural research, publication, oral history, and science departments. Holdings have grown to include more than 1,32,146 titles in the form of manuscripts, books, and documents, hundreds of Tibetan scroll paintings, statues, and other artifacts, and over 15,000 photographs and around 35,000 hours of audiovisual recordings. In addition to its general collection of books and manuscripts, the library houses rare books and manuscripts such as the 12th century handwritten Ashtasahasrika, handwritten Pugda Kangyur, Narthang Kangyur and Tengyur, Shol Kangyur, and Peking Kangyur and Tengyur. Oral traditions are very susceptible to permanent loss should their transmission be interrupted. So, till date, the library's significant oral history project holds thousands of hours of recordings related to the Tibetan diaspora. The library also houses active Tibetan and non-Tibetan publication departments, which together have published more than 500 titles in Tibetan, English, and Hindi concerning Buddhist philosophy and other aspects of Tibetan culture, including journals and newsletters. As a center for education, the library has welcomed scholars and eminent personalities from all corners of the globe and has had a proud association with many of the world's most eminent Tibetologists. The Library of Tibetan Works and Archives is also actively working to develop relationships with world-class academic institutions around the globe to encourage cultural exchanges and other resources. As a result, the library has signed a memorandum of agreement with Federal University of São Paulo, Brazil in 2009, Kalmyk State University and Russian Academy of Sciences in the year 2010. Realizing the importance of scientific education for Tibetan monastics and at the behest of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, the library began a historic project in 1999 to introduce science to Buddhist monastic scholars. With the support of the Sego Family Foundation, more than 300 monks and nuns have completed their science education under eminent science teachers from around the world. On 11th June 2010, an agreement was signed between the library and Emory University in Atlanta to bring modern science education to Tibetan monastic institutions and bring the Tibetan science of mind into modern education by developing and implementing a comprehensive and sustainable science education program for Tibetan monks and nuns. Under the Emory Tibet Science Initiative, around 100 monks and nuns graduated from 5 years of 1-month-long intensive science education from distinguished Emory professors. In yet another historic moment in the history of Tibet and Tibetan Buddhism, monks from various Tibetan monasteries were selected to study science at the Emory University. These monks formally undertook to study a field of knowledge beyond their curriculum, and that too in a Western university. After the completion of their courses, the first batch of monks are now serving as science teachers and leaders in their respective monasteries, while the second batch continues their education. The Library of Tibetan Works and Archives is not only a library, a museum, and an archive, but also an academic institute where cultural and educational courses, seminars, conferences, workshops, and lecture series are held, providing wider avenues of learning and sharing the knowledge that helps promote an environment which fosters research and an exchange of knowledge among scholars, researchers, students, and interested general public. Using modern media and technology in restoring, protecting, preserving, and promoting the Tibetan culture is another initiative by the library. The library has so far scanned and digitized numerous rare documents, pictures, and recordings, thereby laying the foundation for future production of them in formats of the changing technology. In its more than 4 decades of service, the library has made significant contributions at numerous fronts in preserving and promoting Tibetan culture. The Library of Tibetan Works and Archives is confident in its role of preserving and educating others about a compassionate and nonviolent culture facing threat of total extinction in its own homeland. Now, in its 5th decade, the library continues to develop as the need for such an institution becomes more urgent. The library holdings increase every year, and enrollments in philosophy, language, and cultural courses continue to climb. Each year sees an increasing number of visitors, researchers, and students drawn to this institution, which is able to provide them with an educational and cultural experience hard to avail elsewhere in the world. With much achieved and much planned, the library looks forward to more fruitful years to come.
I will already 10 minutes past. I'm aware of the time. So I will just make a brief outline how we are overseeing many of the science initiatives that are taking place due to the guidance of His Holiness. The Science for the Monks is an initiative that took place since year 2001 to 2007. That was followed by the Sagar Science Leadership. The leadership program came into being because we felt that it's important not only to give the basic science education, but also to create a network of science teachers or others who do the field work in different monasteries so that whatever projects we want to complete, we have the networking. It is only that way that we can work. And then we also gradually started the monastic graduates program, which included Kembos, Gehis, Lobuns, because we felt it's important to, in a way, the top-down kind of approach so that it will be more effective for this initial program. And then we also started a number of conferences and also exhibitions that went to US, India, Nepal, Bhutan. And then we had the Emory Tibet Science Initiative coming in 2008, which Geshe-la will talk about it. Then we also have this project of translating scientific terms and publishing bilingual scientific texts. And because of all this enormous amount of work, we also opened a separate science department in the library so that we are in a much more efficient way to handle all this. And the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives is also, from 2014, working with the Department of Religion, Central Tibetan Administration, for another science program with select monks. And the library staffs are also teaching science to the nuns in the nunneries in the vicinity of library. And the library is also connected to the Young Tibetan Scientific Society. In the very beginning when they started, we have a connection with them. And we have very much hope with these young people, and your advice and support are very much needed for these young people who have that initiative. And then one of the most major achievement was being able to introduce science study as a part of the regular monastic study. And we, the library, is also fortunate now to be able to become a co-local organizer with this one and the previous Mind Lab conferences. So in this way, what I'm really trying to say is the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives is fortunate that we got connected to all these science endeavors which are taking place under the guidance of His Holiness Dalai Lama. And the next few points that I would like to talk about is the topic challenges and opportunities. And I always feel that challenges itself, if you face it, will give you the opportunity. And to face that challenge, what we really need to do is to make the students, the monks, to be able to see the goal, the benefit of it. And it is through this way then you will be able to actively engage into it. And for example, just to give one or two examples, during this, many of these monastic programs, we have these days monks and nuns from over 20 different traditions. When they spend 1 month long together, they become friends, which is the best form of dialogue between the Tibetan Buddhist school traditions also. It's very informal, friendly discussion, and long-lasting discussion. Then about getting insights, of course, as we have already heard from the learned speakers during the last few days, you know, with this kind of exchange, when you open up, so much knowledge you can get. So that's very clear. I don't have to elaborate on this. And my personal kind of focus was more on action. Ideas are very important. It always slowly make you change, become better, and things like that. But it's very difficult to do away with the die-hard habit. So forgive me to mention one point. For example, using the plastic bottled waters, which is taking place everywhere, including this conference also. So it's my humble appeal that next time we should be conscious of such things and start doing small bit like that so that we can see the impact and see the difference. Otherwise, the die-hard habit is not going to go away so easily. So that is, I think, all I have to say. And I'm tempted to conclude this by citing some lines which His Holiness mentioned in the Universe in a Single Atom in the concluding chapter. Today, in the first decade of the 21st century, science and spirituality have the potential to be closer than ever and to embark upon a collaborative endeavor that has far-reaching potential to help humanity meet the challenges before us. We are all in this together. May each of us, as a member of the human family, respond to the moral obligation to make this collaboration possible. This is my heartfelt plea. This is a plea which His Holiness made, and I really would like to remind you about all this. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Geshe-la, and thank you for your good work. We need help queuing up the next presentation. And we'll now be hearing from Geshe Lobsang Tenzin Negi, who among his many other roles is the director of the Emory Tibet Partnership and the Emory Tibet Science Initiative.
de cușulos. De cușulos. Isko ulta ho gaya. His Holiness is teasing him, saying maybe people from Kinnor Valley have to wear the opposite way.
Your Holiness. His Eminence Ganden Thi Rinpoche, His Eminence Chapa Chuchi Rinpoche, and His Eminence Chansi Chuchi Rinpoche, esteemed members of the Venerable Sangha and distinguished scholars and the presenters here, it is a great honor and privilege for me today to present to you the progress on the Emory Tibet Science Initiative, an initiative that is formed in collaboration with Library of Tibetan Works and Archives to develop a comprehensive and sustainable science education program for Tibetan monks and nuns. It certainly was a great honor for Emory Tibet Partnership, a partnership that Your Holiness inaugurated in 1998 to foster a cross-fertilization between the Tibetan and the Western forms of knowledge. And in 2006, when Your Holiness invited us to collaborate with the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives to develop this program, that was a great honor for Emory University. Certainly, a program like this, its aim is not only to impart modern science education for the Tibetan monks and nuns, but His Holiness's vision here is to prepare the future contemplative collaborators with the science so that the knowledge, new knowledge, can be formed which can have a tremendous benefit for the humanity at large. We seek to develop a comprehensive and sustainable program for the monks and nuns. When the Emory Tibet Science Initiative was launched in India, of course it was launched at Emory in 2007, but when it was launched in India, Your Holiness made the remarks that this was a dream for long, to bring in modern science into monastic education, and gradually it materialized through the programs like Science for the Monks, Science Meets Dharma, and with the partnership with Emory University and the library, its collaboration with the library, now that this was providing a more stable foundation for such an education to be developed and to implement it. Obviously, this was a very tall mandate for us to develop a comprehensive but a sustainable program, which for us signaled that we have to be very careful, give all the considerations in developing the program that is viable for the monastic education. And therefore, we began with a development phase or the pilot where we wanted to first seek the direction as to which disciplines of science we needed to cover. And fortunate for us, Your Holiness gave that direction and that was to develop courses in neuroscience, physics, and biology with some math. We also consulted with various scholars who had in-depth knowledge in both Western and the Tibetan traditions, such as the esteemed scholar here, Geshe Thubten Jinpala, and other scholars, how to design a course that can actually be fitting for the monastics. And with that, then we began this pilot phase for 6 years in Dharamsala, where we brought professors from Emory and created bilingual text forms both in Tibetan and English. And that translation phase that my colleague Geshe Damtunla will say more about it. But with preliminary textbooks that were specifically created by our faculty for the monastics, we brought in those two cohorts, 91 monks and nuns from 22 different institutions to Dharamsala, and for 6 weeks annually, an intensive education were provided to them, as the result of that, in 2012 and 2013, those two cohorts, the first graduated in 2012 and the second in 2013. Just to hear from Your Holiness this validation for us was a great, great honor, where Your Holiness mentioned at the graduation that for the first time in Tibetan history, monastic students are graduating from a modern science course after having studied it not for a day or two, but for continuously months and years. Now, developing a course for these 6 years was only the first step, although a major milestone. But we needed to find how we can implement in the monastic educations. And thanks to the leadership in the Gelug tradition, under the leadership of His Eminence Ganden Tirumbuche, the leaders of the Gelug order convened this special meeting, the 6th Annual Conference of Gelug International Foundation, in 2012, where they adopted a resolution to integrate the course developed by Emory and the library collaboratively to bring that in the core curriculum, not just kind of ad hoc basis, but to make this a core part of the monastic education. And with that decision taken, we begin the next phase, that is the implementation of the six-year course. And the six-year courses are offered at three locations simultaneously, at the Sera Monastery, Ganden and Debung Monasteries. In summer, for 5 weeks, professors from Emory and the other universities, they come through the Emory Tibet Science Initiative at these three locations to teach for 5 weeks those texts that are prepared by the professors at Emory. Providing the text, of course, are important because the monastics, they are distributed these texts in advance so that they study this. In addition to that, the professors also develop video lectures based on those texts. And then those video lectures are also distributed to the monasteries in advance. Now, at all these video lectures each year are produced in all four disciplines. With the implementation, we added the philosophy of science as part of the first year program. And with video lectures and the textbooks that they receive and that they study. But as much of the learning science is hands-on, they have to actually get into the labs. So as the monasteries are building science centers, Emory University also provides funding for the computers and other lab equipments, as well as the funding for the salaries for year-round unfolding of those texts to the monasteries here. There are 9 monasteries that are participating in this. Tashilumbo, Seraji, and Me, they study here. Debung Gomang, Debung Losiling, Ratwe Monastery monks, and a small Sakya monastery that is based in Munkut, they participate at Debung, and then Ganden Sharse and then Ganden Jangse, they take part in Ganden Monastery. One of the major challenges of the implementation phase is, of course, to impart this education in a very effective way. And for that, we decided that for the first go-around, for the first 6 years, we will bring the faculty from Emory Universities, and these four here And then you will recognize Dr. Carol Beck, Carol Worthman. These four are the leaders that they coordinate in these four areas. And the challenge for us to find enough teachers, this year alone, we had to bring 42 science teachers in the summer. Next year, it's going to be 60 science teachers. By sixth year, when the course is in the sixth year, because there are six classes, then we will need 114 teachers. And so far, that we have been very fortunate to see the enormous interest among the faculty, not only at Emory, but there are various universities participating in this. All this material that we have developed, the books, the video lectures, these are all available online on the website for free distribution for all the monasteries, nunneries, and even in Tibet, there are people that who receive this material. So one kind of concern that I have right here is that although we are providing this material, we are providing this material to every institution, the monasteries and nunneries, but so far we have not been able to actually provide the summer intensives to the nuns. I wonder if it might be possible for the nuns to also participate at one of the locations, whether that will be practical or not.
I'm finishing.
Another concern, of course.
So what is the reason? Do you have any idea why that you are not able to do it in a nunnery?
Well, the one of the main reasons is that we have three locations simultaneous at the same time we are providing. So it means that three teams of faculty need to come. To add the fourth one, it's a financial part. But also just to get enough teachers, the four groups of teachers. So I wonder that if the nuns can participate in one of the locations or they distribute it among the various locations. Well, this is something that we are certainly looking at adding the fourth cohort of teachers, if possible, in the future. Another major concern for implementing the science education has to do with whether bringing modern science will undermine the traditional monastic studies. And therefore, to assess that, we conducted some surveys after offering these courses for 2 years, and that with those two classes of the monks at Depong Sera and Ganden, we found that a small percentage of monks certainly found that 5-week intensive, like they're taking five chunk of time for 5 weeks, it did affect their time for traditional studies, for memorization, attending classes, and so forth. But major, 69%, they said that it had no impact on the time for the studies. But even greater than that is when we asked that if the modern science education was beneficial for them, with the 96% reported that it was beneficial. It was beneficial to not only to learn new concept, but to understand Buddhist concepts in some cases. That it gave them confidence about the Buddhist principles itself, raised new questions about Buddhism, and opened new avenues for ideas.
Marta, tajunge matre, tambunge mati, alawo, laden, nang.
And one thing that it did not, it doesn't seem to impact on the traditional study also is I'm very fortunate to report to you, His Holiness, that like, for example, the six scholars that then as under the program Tenzin Gyatso Science Scholars we bring to Emory University to study for 2 years. And so that they become the teachers in the future in the monasteries. Two of these cohorts have already graduated and have come back. A number of them have gone to Geluk exams. They have done very, very well. For example, Thapke Lotu from this monastery, actually that in his class he stood first, not only the first, but between the first and the second with a 40 points margin, the difference. So all the others who have gone through Geluk exams also have done very well. And the third cohort is at Emory University right now. Another part, as I mentioned earlier, it has to do with the funding, we have been offering this. For example, this year alone, we dedicated 1.4 million, these are distributed. That a large part goes to the six scholars. 120,000 of that actually comes from Your Holiness, from Ganden Potang, the Dalai Lama Trust, and then and His Holiness has also, over the time, contributed $1 million that we have kept in an endowment, so that we can continue. So, Your Holiness, the potential for this program to contribute to the discoveries of new knowledge that can contribute to humanity is truly tremendous, and only a visionary like Your Holiness can conceive of such a program and to see it through. All the faculty members, many of them are here that who have participated, deeply believe in your vision. And the Emory University, the many faculty, including President Wagner, who is stepping down next year, that have been very, very thankful, great supporter. I pray for long prayers from Your Holiness and the Sangha for his life, a good life, a great long life for him and his family. And for myself personally, there is no greater purpose than to serve Your Holiness. And and I pray to be cared for Your Holiness from life after life.
Thank you. Thank you, Geshe-la. Beautiful. Here.
Yeah,
sure. Annette, can you help? Okay. Next. Geshe-la.
Yes. Yes. Shredeng Thaliya. That so she to Sanjeve Che Jig Lambda Luzu Tabujani, Dodeva Maimba. Jig Gunzation and Tabatova Jimbina. Jig Piget Sinrig. That's a Namchat in the Chigoro Chick, but a Mongom Rigwenala, as long as Zur saw what is not soon she would did. 생기기 这是能够是拍戏要买的 Chambuji draws Kavayina, Tindrigida, Dela Hawajigi, and then Gazin Chiklojon Chesha, Yamnisha, Dela Hawajigi, that if you get Dodu, the Lodger, you know, Yaman. Oh, so today in the Sunday, Zo Dirisha, so Susie, so Sajavi Chugi, the Dinky Shakesuity, Yahushi Puke, Shemashi, but I did it. I think I'm going to go to the 아니 먼저 사체 먼저 뭉치사 서로 드스테디 근데 가서서는 이제 어 딱네 먼저 배워 줘서 좀 좀 듣고 찬스 그거 야구지 그게 고아도 마 살체 근데 찬싱을 안 주는 이유가 굶시 소지가 친절 드스테디 어 생아디 녀가스 그 동물도 어 녀마 유선님 이가는 게 참 주스도 앞에 아래 아니 링룸 주시고 아메리카도 발에 주스페 용어요. 사인은 지금 뭐 이야기 참무 친데도 누구들 또 쓰리잖아요. 아제 단이 뭐 봐봐 공공을 지기. 아니 그러한 소리 잘 쓰고 줘야 되버 지기. 이제 공주신 숨이 수조대 지금 사제배 출을 신의 대화 떠버지다. 아니 지금 영어로 전부 이해되버지나 어떻게 구조체도 견해 말이. 전 된 양각에 또 수조된 거란 저 댄스 빛이 지겠다. 어다시 지난주 즉 측감부 장장 실럽체. 그게 심부 띵네 즉 산제비 출을 신의 타버 터버시기 나 소야디 계속 시작하셔. 난디 지금 그게 답은 나는 거죠. 근데 즉 시라마를 지금 좀 전화하셔서 시행 주셨네. 어다 시라마도 스고르 스고르서 소시 마도 예 심심가 소화하기 힘도 한다. 가서 그게 낭배슝 나러래다 저제디 그 겸하고 충주자는 고셔서는 그 힘도 와. 아 소스데 지베 지베 잡아베 탈 투구지다. 아 지기 타네 이니 남샤 샤샤 디디 치즘 지베 잡아이나 델이야 네버 토야 소지. 따바나도 천지 타네 가서랑 가서 계속 송아. 지 강사 살살살 파파파 시즌에 나 때는 딱 왜 강의야 지 그 다 여러 년 로직도 와 나가는 시 관람 회사 시행에서는 소 전직원의 최신원의 주매도 받고 다 여러 년 로직도 와 아니 행인은 비다 와리 시행이고 그 상품 리뷰 거리 시행이나 아니 지리자가 박외유 양궁관에서 답변 날린데 추주기 상품 리뷰 다당관에서 배배 로동자하고 태중계야 소로 된다 된다 배지 아용 삼기 나 뒤죽 차네 나 지금 론진 체아래 겨장 체아래 나 된다게 타려야 준비 준비 뒤죽 줘야 소로 된대 거기다 용시버리 나 드즈체디 컨저스도 와 현지 파 나 무시한데 천지를 생기디 긴두분 용서로게 러야케 말와 배지 용서로 말와 자 나 디엠으로 말 가서 올 때지 지금 니에다 다가 캠보나 모조다 지 기견수 체니 그냥 선다 버셔 구두제 지 그게 견접 하야게 시로 된제 연구도는 디시도 컨디스도와 전 특이한 건 안다 그 조부지 계시죠 저 당아주 들이 레가 사바 제요 뭐이나 그 신의 지 냠뇽으로 사제 두수 연두 견접 해봐도 용 시그리스 견접 전부 중어다가 어디다 야구면 두실라 봐이나 종으로 다스 나도 최선을 삼다고로 최선 삼다면 다들 전문이 네가라 다 들은 주서 집에 갈래 되어래 간다 지지산 얘기 쉬어 사고도요 표 강생이 정말 여드베 배 날린데 취규디 나서 고생해지나 모서로 끼니 내가 판매네 뒤쳐디 저명이 미주디 돈아 사업이 되기도 나도 당연히 당 걸어 장장시 두스 때여나 뛰어야 말이 봐 말한 거는 다시 남주기 그게 가서 또 남주기 쎄래 텀베 지금 시세 고도 강성지 여자분 뒤에 난 전문의 질을 샴도 주야다 전문의 질을 판단하지 그런 가서 근주 땡주 부두 숨겨 나네 생리기 때문에 지금 채 아니 떠르고 때문에 나라 댄시도 사시나 산지에 비추든 태그런 좋아요 아래 대민기 지금 대니가 남샤 서로 지금 다 드즈체디 간다 질기다 간다 나네 미드버사디 고 셰고야 지다 드즈체디 고 계속 쉬고 쳐도 와
Was it translated at all? No. Translated. So I'll just give a little summary. This was in responding to Geshe Lobsang Denzinla's presentation of some of the challenges based particularly on the survey that was conducted on the question list. There were, one of the questions was, you know, does the teaching of science affect your faith in the Dharma, faith in Buddhism? And there were also questions about whether the actual... I think, you know, it was translated, but just to summarize the main point, His Holiness was making the point in response to that particular question, and there were two, we need to distinguish between two types of questions. One is a more practical question about the challenges, constraints imposed by introducing a new curriculum such as science, and, you know, to what extent it is affecting the timing of people spent, for example, like in memorization and recitations and so on. And the other question is a deeper question, you know, whether or not teaching of science will undermine in the monks, you know, faith to the Dharma in their classical studies. And in the second question is more important, because here it depends very much upon the individual's relationship with the Buddha Dharma. If the individual's relationship with the Buddha Dharma is based upon some kind of a custom, some kind of a way of, you know, the Tibetan tradition, and it's very much based on faith, then there might be that potential danger. But on the other hand, as monastic scholars are supposed to be, if the individual's engagement with the Dharma is grounded upon a real study and understanding and critical reflection, then if you look at the many of the Buddha's key teachings, for example, that has to do with two truths, which is, you know, understanding of the nature of reality, and also the teachings that are embodied in the Four Noble Truths, which is an attempt to integrate the understanding of nature, reality, and applying into one's life. You can also look at the teaching on bodhicitta, which is the cultivation of infinite altruism, and also wisdom. And yesterday we had discussions about, you know, the synergy between the way in which scientists are beginning to understand what sense of self is. And there was an understanding how, in some ways, the various moves in Western philosophy and science... As part of the critical reflection process, you know, what, it may seem as if there is a lot of confusion. I mean, yesterday we saw how terms can mean so many different things. Different thinkers are looking at it from different angles. The same is true in the West as well as among the Nalanda scholars as well. Sometimes there is what seems like a confusion. But then if you look at the ones more settled ideas, you know, then even in the West you can see the kind of, you know, perspectives on self are beginning to move towards the Buddhist perspectives of, you know, interdependent convergence and designation, designated self and conventional reality. So the point is that if your understanding and if your engagement with the Dharma is really grounded upon understanding critical reflection, there shouldn't be any danger. So this is the case in my own personal life, and it reminds me a story of Gyabje Ling Rinpoche and Gyabje Tishan Rinpoche, my two tutors, when they first went to the West. And Gyabje Ling Rinpoche, the senior tutor, told me that when he saw all the colorful material affluence in the world and the lifestyle people were living, you know, there was no attraction on his part because it was just so busy. There wasn't much time for people to really reflect. And he saw the kind of pointlessness of that kind of consumerist materials pursuit. And this is the kind of strength a genuine practitioner has, whose understanding of the world is really grounded upon a firm conviction in the Dharma. So for these kind of people, then there shouldn't be any problem. But one could say that, for example, His Holiness was saying that in the early days when he used to come and visit South India, there were a lot of monks chanting text, reciting text, rehearsing at night. There seemed to be left fewer of them. And he says he doesn't think it has to do with science. It probably has to do with more distractions around. You know, in the old days, there were no digital devices. There were no easy access to these entertainment devices. But now there are. So I don't think His Holiness says he doesn't think it has anything to do with the science. But when it comes to the time allotment, then it is the responsibility of the authorities to think seriously. And there will be challenges, but when you confront challenges, you should not just give up, saying this is too difficult, it's too much. Challenges should be the opportunity to rise to it. And this is really up to the authorities to see how to adjust so that the primary purpose of the monastic institution is the study of the classics and Buddhist thought, that these are not undermined, that the science study really complements them. And in fact, those who are Buddhist scholars who have studied science will tell you that in fact the deeper understanding of the science really enhances and deepens their understanding of the Dharma. So this is the way in which the students should be guided. And in the end, it's really the responsibility of the authorities and the teachers. So don't blame me for bringing science into the monastery.
Well, thank you, Your Holiness, for your observations and advice. We're acutely aware of the shortage of time, and in the interest of time, Geshe Dadul has graciously agreed to try to compress his 15-minute talk into 5 minutes, and I hope perhaps Rinpoche also. So talk slowly, but just less.
Your Holiness, as always, it is indeed a great privilege to be in your presence and making a presentation. But at the same time, this has always been a feature when being in your presence, making presentation, that I feel nervous, at the same time very embarrassed that I would be taking some time in making not so significant a presentation. And my respects goes to all the monastics led by His Eminence Ganden Tirimboche and his two designated successors, and also to the august presenters here together with the general audience. My presentation is like this. Yeah, that's okay. Yeah. My presentation will be a big shift from the previous two presenters. They dealt mainly with the administration, the organization part of it. Mine will be strictly into the, if I may, academic part of it, the translation process. So through these, you'll be opened to the translation processes that we're engaging in. Mainly my message here is that is to assure our scientists, as well as the monastics, that when we do the translation, we do not take it lightly, but rather we take it so seriously that we try to really catch all the nuances and convey them. And through examples, it will be apparent, I hope. So the translation process is like this. we begin with referring to any existing sources in target language. And then we refer, when it comes to actually translating a term, we refer to the origin of the terms. And then we discuss it with our peers, and then consult it with the experts in the respective fields. That would be mainly the faculty members at Emory and others. And then we try to reach consensus about the terms. Initially, the individual translators will be coining the terms, but then that will be tabled for discussion among scholars during our annual conferences. Only then those terms go into the published publications, not until then. And then before we actually publish it, we run the manuscript through series of revisions for improvement of the rendition in language. Yet at the same time, we do not stop there. We are always open for improvement. So that's the whole process in the translation. So this is how we discuss among peers, colleagues. This is a translation conference. It began in 2009, and it has been annually held. The one in 2016 will be the eighth in series. This is just a sample of experts that we consult. And then the general principles that we follow is, yes, the topmost is faithful conveyance of the content at all costs. And then we try to use whatever available resources and vocabularies are there in the target language, and then maintain the feeling of a foreign setting whenever necessary to convey not just the content, but also maintain the ambience so that the person who reads it also gets the background thinking about it. And then strictly follow the tactical rules of the target language. They do not always match with the source language. So that part we always give the priority to the target language. And then clearly distinguish between translation and editorialization. Every now and then we remind ourselves, oh, I'm doing translation, not editorialization. And then, yes, the last is aim for a smooth flowing in the target language. So the methods employed in the actual process, wherever possible, we try to do direct translation, whereas we do that only for the common nouns, not the proper nouns. Because proper nouns such as the Charles Goodman would translate as Mi Yakpo, Choga Yakpo, Lakwa Sangbo. But if we were to do that, it would sound like, oh, it might be a Tibetan American. So we do not do that. Whereas in translating Buddhist texts, most of the translators have done that also, translating it. Now, indirect translations, this would be an example of it. Phonetic transliteration, there are so many different ways, but we try to among those possible versions, we try to prefer the second one, the precision one, worrying so much about how it fits with the synthetical rules of the language, but rather the phonetics. And then wherever possible, we try to add a cue to that. And then among the direct translations, there are so many different ways. We take that liberty in changing the order, if need be, adding some feature or omitting some feature if it doesn't, damage the content. And conforming to the sources, philosophical and cultural paradigms. That's what I meant by the setting. Whenever there is a foreign setting, ambience that needs to be conveyed with it, we try to be sensitive to that, be that in the philosophical aspect or in the cultural aspect. Now, yeah, this synonyms. We try to be very, as I said earlier, we are taking this very seriously. Suppose, take the case of neuron and nerve cell. They mean the same thing. We could have gone with just one term, but we try to stick to the differences there and convey the different, and then stay consistent with that. And then in the case of brain cell, this is slightly different from neurons. We try to convey that through that. And then nervous system, neural system are very subtly different, and so we try to convey that. So that's an example. And then there are subtle differentiations that need to be conveyed, and then I try to come up with as compact way of conveying it. So these are examples. And then improvisation. Sometimes there is need of improvisation. Lysis, lysing, we have to take the lie part of it. Although here one dengpo is missing. I meant to put two dengpos there so that just from looking at it, it will look that it is not Tibetan. Yet at the same time, it helps in giving you the same, the original pronunciation, yet at the same time, the combination then makes it. So basically, lysing, lysing. So cell, body, and soma, I may take time here. Sometimes people take this easily and say, oh, cell, body means body of a cell, which is not. Cell, body is just a specific part of the body of the cell. So that's how we try to then convey it slightly different in Tibetan. Likewise, it's also called by that same name, soma, but then we try to then convey it so lu. So that way it conveys that. There are challenges there. There are challenges there that now I will not go into it, particularly about life, life and living in one monastic education, monastic program. People, monastics make difference between living and life. Whereas in English, there is nothing. Where if anything is living, then you have to say that it has life. Whereas the monastics, by using the Tibetan terms, tend to make a differentiation. They say, oh yeah, it is living, but it doesn't have a life. So it has to do with how we convey it in Tibetan. But these are challenges. And then impose differentiations. Sometimes we have to resort to the same existing terms, yet have to be mean differently as against the usual usage of it. And then new distribution. Emotion, we use nyongsor, semyong, for empathy, nyamnyong gisem, or nyamnyong, like that. Innovation is required. So there are still some room, some areas where we need innovation, and for that we need some consensus in how we do that. One of them is abbreviating the elements, how we abbreviate it. Right now, we either put the English one or you put the whole name, but not otherwise. Moving forward, we need to be prepared. Right now, do whatever we can at present, and then aim at uniformity, but uniformity not in a very light sense. We need to be really standardizing it. And then for that, we need to have discussion forums. And then some kind of a translation board. Translation board which consists of members from different translation boards. So that whenever some kind of a consensus is reached, that can be then carried away to the existing different translation boards. And thus, that will strike uniformity. And then, yes, concerted effort from everyone. With that, I end it. Thank you so much once again.
Thank you so much. 15 minutes in half the time.
That's great.
So much work. Thank you. But next we're hearing from Yangtze Rinpoche, who's the president of Maitreya College. And we hope you can be as similarly speedy.
So, permission from His Holiness, and Ganenche Rinpoche, and Shajang Chuji Nambani, and all the Sangha Vinaya holders, my deep homage. So my task is over here to give a different perspective the Buddhist science to presenting in an academic setting into a secular world, secular audience. So there's a few points that I'm going to talk into these 3 points. In the West, in any kind of education. First, students are really demands, is the institution is a credit or not credit. If the institution is not credit, the education is, although education can be a really profound, but there is a not kind of like a legal recognition for the education. So this is becomes very important for the Western setting. So I'll talk a little bit about the accreditation because the college that I'm working, we're trying to get credit by, we are already credited by the state, but we are trying to get a credit from the more the accrediting board. So I'll talk a little bit about that. And that's kind of like the bigger organization kind of view. And the second part is the really challenge into the classroom when you're trying to teach Buddhist science into the Western audience, what kind of they have, how they process such information. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And then the third point is the higher education related with the world peace. That's my personal point of view, so I'll talk that. So this is, you know, I'm very grateful that I'm so much influenced by His Holiness. I really feel fortunate. And so education is the power. So just want to put that over there. Particularly the higher education. So in the past, the countries became superpower because of the information and education, and also that will be in the present, that will be also in the future. So this kind of like nurturing education and respecting for education, I think this is like a hope for this planet. So just put the statement over there. So what is accreditation? So I'm not going to go into detail because you know, something that any 21st century in education without credit, and I think it becomes kind of like a less credential, and also at the bigger picture, the longevity of the education becomes a question from my perspective. If we just stay as a, like a, for example, Mind and Life institution, if this institution is accredited, I think this will be incredible. If this Mind and Life institution just stay in the, as a level of a, just of an institution, I think, from my perspective, I think it becomes very limited. So, like, sometimes I think there will be, like, Mind and Life University in Bangalore or Mind and Life University in Boston or something like that. So, so basically, a key thing is any education that we do should have something integration of the legal recognition. For example, in today's world, if individual person, we do exist, but if we don't have the government issue ID that recognize we do exist, it, basically we don't exist. So therefore, education should be legally recognized. So therefore, accreditation becomes, I think, a very important part of the longevity of education. So I'm not going to go through all that details. And now I'll go to, so basically, accreditation.
Down up, sir. In
the bottom up now.
What the?
Bottom up.
The, no matter how small, you see the effect to young student, really, I said the kasoda.
Evidence.
Then time passes. I think more and more people support that. Then recognition come. Other side, something big, recognize, substance, not much.
Yes.
Yes.
So His Holiness, you know, wondering that the, whether the top-down approach right from the beginning versus bottom-up approach, which one is more effective? The bottom-up, he would argue the bottom-up approach is more effective because if you have a real quality education and more people notices and appreciates it, then in fact the accreditation process becomes much easier because there is already a wellspring of admiration and appreciation of that quality.
No. So now I'll go to my pretty much last slide. This is basically not in the institution level, but it's much more in a classroom that in a Buddhist science when you're trying to teach into a secular audience. You know, one main thing is the material. Again, same thing. You know, science when you're teaching in the monastery, we have there's a material, and same thing. I think is facing the same kind of a challenge. And another one is the translation, and again, in the same problem. You know, when you teach Buddhist science, there's a since it's a science, you have to have a very accuracy. There's all the time face challenge of that, and also the methodology. You know, when you're trying to teach the Buddhist science into a Western audience, there is a different approach, and that approach also sometimes face some kind of difficulty challenge. So, furthermore, taking a time, this is a prayer, Your Holiness, may you live a very long life and to wish fulfill all your holy wish. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much to all four of the presenters. This concludes the first part of our afternoon session. And now we'll segue to a concluding session.
Musical chairs. Matthew, come. There's a space here. There's a space here. Why don't you move up?
I want to thank the Tibetan scholars so much for their extraordinary effort in integrating science into the monastic curriculum. I mean, it's just astonishing to have been part of Mind and Life since its onset and to see the work that Emory and other institutions have done in bringing science into the foreground for monastics. And I very much appreciate the intention to do this for the nuns as well. I just want to kind of underline that. But, you know, this kind of integration makes it more possible for deeper collaborations between Buddhist scholars, Tibetan scholars, and Western scholars and scientists. So the conversations that we are engaged in here in Mind and Life take on a whole other dimensions when there is a kind of common ground which we share. So we have 30 minutes for the concluding session, and we're going to ask John Dunn to do a very brief summary of the arc of our time together.
Thank you, Joan. Your Holiness, it's a difficult task to summarize our last few days together because we've covered a lot of ground. We've had a wide-ranging conversation, but let me just remind us of some of the key points of each of our speakers. And of course, we began with Thupten Jinpa himself, whose account of the Buddhist theory of perception, one of the key points that raised for us was the way in which examining our own experience in this rigorous way actually reveals that much of what we take for granted may in fact be false or deluded. In particular, there's a very strong connection, as Thupten Jinpa showed, between perception and concepts. We then moved on to Pavan Sinha, and one of the most important features of Pavan Sinha's talk is the way in which that visual system itself actually develops, is highly plastic, so there's a great possibility for transformation, but also that visual system develops as a child, one of the Prakash children, is enacting themselves in the world, is active in the world, that there's a need for movement, for dynamic information processing, and that this process of developing perception is not just a bottom-up process, but also a top-down process. We then had Kathy Kerr's presentation, and part of what Kathy Kerr showed us is the importance of the complexity of this relationship between the top-down and the bottom-up. When we look at the sense of the body, bodily perception in particular, we see that the mind, signals of pain, for example, from the gut, can be enhanced by the way they're interpreted in the mind, but likewise, that same enhancement can have a rebound effect. There is a relationship between the top down and the bottom up. When we attend to a sensation in our finger, the way we attend to that sensation can enhance the signal, but that then the enhanced signal then alters our interpretation also. So there's a kind of very complex reciprocal process where really making the distinction between top and bottom becomes very difficult. I then spoke about the way in which Buddhists theorize the formation of concepts. And one of the key issues in the Buddhist theory of formation, of concept formation, is that our concepts of the world are not simply categories out there in the world, but they are dependent very much on our interests. They are dependent upon what we seek to obtain and what we seek to avoid, and even to some extent our emotional states. This can be carried even further into the role that language plays in concept formation, and that's what Lera Boroditsky brought to our understanding. One of the most important aspects of this, of course, is not simply that our own experiences form our concepts, but the cultures in which we're embedded and the languages that we use also have a tremendous effect. And a lot of these effects can be conceptualized as being in a kind of top-down process. Now, both perception and concepts are very closely tied to the self. The self is the one who is enacting those concepts in the world. The self appears to be the one who is receiving those perceptions or actually enacting those perceptions. And so we had an entire day then in which we talked about the self. Geshe Ishi Thubge focused especially on the way in which Buddhists negate a particular kind of self, but not self in general. And Jay Garfield helped us to see the way in which seeing through the illusion of self enables us to have a kind of moral perception that sees others in a way that no longer reifies them into selves as that illusion would have us do. Finally, Vasu, yesterday afternoon, gave us an account of the development of self, moving from a very basic sense of the self as a perceiver into a much more complex sense of self that is in relation to the other, something that we see emerging very early in infants. Matthew then brought this all together, especially in terms of altruistic action in the world. How does our sense of who we are, how does the way we receive we see the world, how does the way we think of the world, how can all of that come together in compassionate action? And Richie then led us into some of the actual research that is already emerging in this direction, and then some of the potential future research that we see that comes out of these kinds of understandings and insights. So that's been our entire, in 4 minutes, that's been our entire week. I hope that it made some sense, and it gives us some basis for summarizing our conversation now.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John, especially for the wonderful integration. I'd like to just spend a few moments reflecting on the extraordinary setting in which this meeting has occurred, the value, Your Holiness, of meeting in a monastic setting. This is our second meeting in a monastery. And to witness firsthand the extraordinary change that Your Holiness's vision has brought about. I was so touched sitting on the steps and listening to the debate, observing the debate about waves and particles. And I just whispered to Thupten Jinpa, can you have envisioned when you were in the monastery that a debate like this would ever be occurring? And it's remarkable to see the transformation that's occurred the wellspring of activity that this has catalyzed. And I reflect in many ways on the conservatism and stasis of the academy in the United States. I suspect this is true of most parts of the Western world. In many ways, I think that what you have done in the monasteries is reflects a greater openness and permeability than we see in the United States. Despite the fact that there is great freedom in the United States, there is a that there is an inherent conservatism, and it's difficult for me to envision such a large collection of American academics from different disciplines listening to a group of Geshe's discourse on the nature of perception and the self. And so I think this is a testament to something really extraordinary that is occurring. One of the other great contributions that I think we've taken from the dialogues with Buddhism has been an emphasis on plasticity, on the possibility of change. And while certainly there's a lot of scientific research that's now consistent with that, you've helped us to focus on plasticity, particularly in domains that really matter in our individual lives. And you've shown us, by example, the importance of warm-heartedness and how an understanding at a very deep level of innate basic goodness can transform everyday life. And so I think that this is something that the scientists will take away from their time here and will begin to think about how it can get translated into their own work in America and elsewhere in the world. So,
we can do it.
So we have just a little bit of time left, and I think now is a time to just ask each of the participants to reflect very briefly on her or his experiences, and then to also ask Your Holiness to reflect. So,
and in this regard, I think it's really important for us to think about the way forward, the questions that we feel are important as we move out of this meeting to bring it not only into our disciplines, but also into the mission of mind and life. So maybe we can begin with Jinpa.
I don't think I... Well, I mean, it's been a real pleasure and privilege to be part of this gathering and also have the opportunity to really present, in some sense, represent the voice of the Tibetan monastic academia here. And one thing that I would take home is, you know, as an interpreter, translator myself, the need for even more self-critical awareness of the way in which we use terms. And one thing that became very, very clear here is the word perception is used in a really, really different way in different contexts. The other thing is that also I was particularly struck by Lara's presentation because one of the implicit kind of, you know, ideas in Dhammakirti is the philosophy of language. And, you know, I noticed in Lara's presentation, there's a lot more explicit exploration in the area where Dhammakirtian approach tends to assume, and this seems to be one area where I personally felt that I might actually learn more. But one thing that was very moving for me personally is, you know, your Holiness, in your opening remarks, you really made the powerful case of why science in a monastery. And right now, just a few minutes before, you spoke about how, you know, a real study of science should not undermine, you know, the kind of the veracity of the classical education. And this was very moving, and I see you as, of course, a father figure of the Tibetan Monastic Academia, and it was just so moving to see you express the sense of concern that you have for this education. And I'm not a monk anymore, but it's something that I care deeply. Thank you.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. As a scientist, I'm deeply impressed by how very little we actually know about the human mind and about the human experience. There are 7,000 languages in the world, and only 10% of those are well described. About 98% of what we know about the mind and the brain is based on American college students. Way of doing science makes our findings really biased and really narrow. And so science has to broaden out if we're going to really understand human experience in all its richness. And of course, one way is for scientists to come here and speak to you, but another way is for everyone here to start doing your own science and start contributing your experiences and your findings and your voices to the scientific community. Because science is not just something that you learn, science is something that you do. It's a practice. Mm-hmm. And you don't need a fancy degree to do it, you just need knowledge and you need to use the scientific method. And so I hope that these kinds of dialogues will lead many more people around the world to contribute to science. And without all of your help, we actually can never achieve a very good science of the mind.
Well, Lara, thank you.
Thank you.
Your Holiness, it's been a real privilege to be here with you and with these wonderful colleagues this week and to be so well received by the community here, even though they all know much more about Dharmakirti than I do. One of the things that I think has most arisen for me is the importance, but the potential importance of what we might call the view, the tawa, and the implication, especially
tawa.
The implication, especially in this context, is that our view actually may have a tremendous impact on the way we interpret our world and the way we behave. So how, in what way do we change our view concretely? What are the practices that change our view? And can we actually do research that examines the process of changing the view and enacting that changed view in the world? Some of that kind of research already exists. Some is being done in our center at Madison. But I think there's much more to explore in this regard.
Your Holiness, it's been a true honor for me to be to have been here in your presence and in the presence of this distinguished gathering. And this meeting over the past 4 days has exemplified, amplified, and reinforced a theme that I deeply cherish, and that's the theme of bringing together the worlds of the heart and mind, the notion of compassionate science. And I believe that that's an avenue that is going to become more and more powerful and more fruitful as we progress further. And it's precisely these kinds of dialogues that are going to show to the world the power and the importance of undertaking that approach. Thank you very much.
Your Holiness, thank you again deeply for this honor of being here and of listening to your views. The thing that I take away from here is, again, this idea something that you have spoken very much about, the inseparability, the connection between the organism which knows, whether it's monastic, and that which we know. And I think one of the things that struck me is how little we know about the different paths that the mind can take and that context and engagements can provide. And my wish would be that both in science and in the way in which we incorporate science into society, we take seriously the idea that people are to be seen as subjects, as thous, and not as objects. Mm. And how we actually fully implement it, I don't know, because we are still in the mood of objectifying everything. Thank you.
Beautiful.
Your Holiness, it is always an honor and a privilege to be in your presence. It is an honor to be in this august university with this wonderful Sangha, and also to be in the company of such esteemed colleagues. And so I thank you for that opportunity. I think we've learned a lot here, and one of the things we've learned is that science can be pursued in a way that takes human beings seriously. We've seen that in Vasu's science, in Lara's science, in Kathy's science, and in particular in Pawan's science. We've also seen that science can be a deep force for good, and that it ought to be a force for good. But we've also seen, especially in Mathieu's work, that philosophy and understanding can equally be a force for good. And I think that's extraordinarily important to remember, that philosophical study as well as scientific study can deepen our understanding. In my own work as a translator, I'm always dismayed by how much, as Richie mentioned, the Western world is capable of ignoring the riches of the Buddhist philosophical world. And I'm also, when I teach in Buddhist institutions, always dismayed at how little Western philosophy is appreciated. So one of the things that I would urge going forward is more dialogue that integrates both philosophy and science in the service of good, and integrating Western and Tibetan approaches in science and philosophy. I think it's extremely important as we move forward, but always with the notion that we're moving towards the good and that we Madhyamakas have to stick together.
Was it translated or?
Just the end.
Geshe-la was giving the analogy. There is an idea in Buddhist epistemological thinking that when it comes to the process of human cognition, we begin with a direct perception that is closer to reality. And then when that perception is clear, it gives rise to perceptual judgment. And based upon that, you can infer various qualities of that object. But that chain of inference, in order for it to help us serve our purpose, it needs to be a valid chain. So which means ultimately it also ends up in a direct experience of contact with the real
thing in the world. So there is a kind of an arc. And in this, there is this idea that the underlying drive is a kind of a human desire to achieve a goal. So similarly, listening to the presentations here, you know, we know that, you know, one thing that was made very clear is that the classical Indian understanding that if you look at any human activity, whether it is linguistics, whether it is, you know, arts and crafts, even whether it is parenting, you know, all of that has to be driven by some, you know, kind of desire to fulfill a goal. There's a kind of a purpose. And one, that fact was made very clear in this conversation when you look at, listen to many different presentations coming from many different disciplines, but all of them is pointing towards this human quest for knowledge, human quest to fulfill some aim, whether it is, you know, one's own personal needs or whether it's the more altruistic needs of the larger society. And that's something that I will take home.
So whenever we are together in a Mind and Life event, whether in this kind of setting or different part of the world, many times comes to mind what Your Holiness said in 2000, the first meeting I was present, when you said that middle of the week, it's all nice what we discuss, but what can we contribute to society? And of course, to contribute something to society, it has to begin with the person, individual change. Otherwise, if we don't transform ourselves, how can we transform the world or at least serve others? And for instance, in the humanitarian world, we see that all the time. The purpose is to help others. Then we start, then personal conflict. If things go worse, corruption, and the whole goal is lost because of human shortcomings. So somehow the messenger has to be the message. We have to embody what we try to do, and that has to come to personal change. So in a way, the good thing about that is no matter what happens, even people don't treat us well, or if things don't go the way we want, or some unpredictable events occur, at least there's always a way to transform yourself and therefore to contribute to transform the world. So I also remember once, to summarize in four words, once I was traveling in India in 1967 and I went to a Hindu ashram. There was the bust of the founder, and below it says just, be good, do good. I thought that's a nice motto.
Thank you, Your Holiness. It's very moving for me to be here, and I'm just so honored to be sharing with this incredible group of people. And I think the main takeaway that I have is something that you said on the first day, which was the sense of urgency of, you know, that things have to, we have to move to action now. It's not about prayer or, you know, it's just sitting on our cushions, but there's a sense of urgency. And I am trying to do that in my own work, but there's a way in which, you know, when I work on the basic science mechanisms, it's very important to be very careful and rather slow. And actually, I think that we have a need to translate some of these mechanisms more quickly and try to bring some help to patients and people who are suffering. And I say that as somebody who has dealt with cancer myself. I think that there's just a way in which what I'm going to bring back to Brown and to my colleagues is that sense of the fierce urgency of now, of just let's see what we can do. Let's push it. So thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I share everyone's sense of gratitude that we are all here. It's actually an immense privilege, and so that makes it also a burden and a responsibility in a way to go forward. And so although I resonate with all the things that people have said, I also want to share this issue of right view, the issue of our understanding of perception, our understanding of concepts, and our need for action. Can all be brought together in many ways, but many of us are professors, and we teach. And so one of my big missions, and yes, I work in the Emory Tibet Science Initiative, but actually my big mission that I and my students and my laboratory are working on right now is how we transform the way in which we teach. And so teaching is about not just science, it's about changing the mind, changing to better view, building skills so that students will be empowered not for knowledge, but for the ability to work and think more effectively in the world. And so I hope that through all our work, and certainly it's my aspiration, that I will become a better educator and help to change the way we think and act about education. Thank you.
Professor was, and
I think the deepest reason for our presence here is to end suffering. That is our shared imperative. I so appreciate your comment, Pavan, about the integration of mind and heart, and I would say mind, heart, and body, to name the three domains of subjectivity, but I would say it's mind, heart, body, and the world, that we're not separate from this. And this sense, I feel, is captured in what you transmitted, Kathy, and many of us here in this circle have transmitted, the sense of urgency, that this is not time to squander these precious moments when we're at a climate tipping point with globalization, commodification. Mind and Life has always had a compassion-based vision and mission. But the sense of urgency, the imperative that whatever we engage in here as a community of practitioners of science and also of contemplation as scholars, that we dedicate it completely to the ending of suffering. Thank you.
Your Holiness, it's always such an inspiration to be in your presence and in the hats that I wear as a member of the Board of Mind and Life and also in our own center at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Being in your presence helps to build the confidence that the work we're doing is really incredibly important, and we will rededicate ourselves to do this work in a way which will benefit as many beings as we possibly can. And I simply want to express our deepest, deepest gratitude for all of your time, which has been so extraordinary over such an extended number of decades. It's breathtaking to see what you have been able to achieve with the meetings that we've had and the change that's been produced. May your life be long. May you continue to inspire us. And we look forward to our continuing interactions. Thank you so much, Your Holiness. And now Susan Bauer Wu is the president of Mind and Life, would like to have the final closing words.
Stand? Okay.
Well, it has been an incredible honor for me. This is my second week as president of Mind and Life, and to be here and to start this way is perfect. So I'm really honored and delighted. And I'd like to end by thanking a few people that made this possible, but there are so many people that made this very special event possible. And of course, I can't name everybody, but I will do my best to acknowledge many. So I begin with Your Holiness. Thank you. Thank you for your generous spirit and presence throughout this entire meeting. Very important, so thank you. And also for bringing the monastic community here to participate in this really historical discussion. To be here in this presence with all of them was really special. So thank you for bringing the community to us and us to them. And also for your years of dedication. 3 decades and longer you've been at this. And bringing the conversation between scientists and scholars to engage in the interaction of Buddhist science and modern science in the service of humanity. So important, so thank you. And I next want to thank the venerable abbots and members of the Saraji community and the 2 colleges, Sarah J and Sarah May. Thank you for your very warm hospitality, welcoming us to your community, and just helping us to feel very much welcome and to be here with you. So thank you all. And to the Dalai Lama Trust India, our partners, co-hosts of this event, the generous support, the financial support that helped to make this event possible, and not only possible, but to help it be such a success. Really very, very deeply thanks, and especially a thanks to Jampala Lundup and his entire team for partnering with us. So thank you, Dalai Lama India. And to the staff of the Office of His Holiness, and a special thank you to Secretary Cheme Rinsen, who's been here with us throughout, and also to Tenzin Tagala for working closely with us in our organization of this event. And special thank you to the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives in Geshe La Lakdor and your team for all the translation of the slides, the written materials, so important to make this possible. So thank you so much. And to the simultaneous translators. They have worked nonstop. Every minute of this entire event, they have been working. So our thanks to all of them. Yeah. And the AV support. The AV support has been incredible. So we thank the team of the Dalai Lama Trust India who made it possible for the live streaming for thousands of people around the world, all continents, to be able to participate in this event with us. So we thank them. And also the on-the-ground AV support, and to the Renault AV team, who have been working tirelessly to help us with all the logistics with AV. So thank you. And to the speakers, So the speakers around this table, those who were at the other events that we hosted, really, for your beautiful presentations, so enlightening and so inspiring, and also for taking the time to be here. It's a long time to be here, and it's a very long trip, and so I'm very grateful for you to share and to be here. Just a few more. I'd like to acknowledge the Hershey Family Foundation, who are very important supporters of the Mind and Life Institute and really helped us to all be here today. And I know that Barry Hershey and Connie Hershey send their regards to everyone. And my final thank yous will be Mind and Life specific, because it really takes a village for us to be here. So just a few acknowledgments. To the Mind and Life board and to our members who are here, particularly to our chair, Jimpala. He has been our wonderful leader and also presenter and translator. Deep bow, thank you. And other members just to acknowledge who are here, Richie and Roshi Joan, and also to Carolyn Jacobs. Thank you. Thank you to the Planning Committee. This was an incredible, incredible dialogue. So the members of the committee, Jimpala, Carol Worthman, Jay Garfield, Richie Davidson, and Wendy Hassenkamp. So thank you for just all of your attention of putting together such a fine program. And to the Mind and Life staff, to those that are not here, as well as those that are here. Liza Katz, your attention to detail made it possible. And to Wendy, and to Ned Dunn for his technical support. And it really does take a village to be able to put together something like this and to do it so well and have it be such a success. And a final thank you to the audience who is here, to all of you participants, the monastic community, and our special honorable guests, for being here for the entire time of this event. It has helped to make it be an even more rich and meaningful experience. So we hope to see you at another Mind and Life event. And until we meet again, may you all be very well. Thank you.
Your Holiness, would you like to make a few final words?
I'm going to go to the hospital.
아주 쌉두식 다시로 다니지 배제 요미스로지리 디야 신유지 고개 계신 말이 꼭 간단 거에 있는 전문이 뛰어간다 강해 먹고 싶지 미스의 강해지 미스의 강해지 다 컨저스신의 세구도 삼바지 내가 또 삼으로 냉해야 돼 내 눈이 딱 와셔야 돼 미 동주도 동주시야 돼 이 삼으로 그냥 개이 되지 자자 디네 인도사는 안주한다 Lagati, Kandachi, Namjuk Tane, Mikyan, Yambo, Chia, the Chepchi, Zamuni Diganga, Kanyo Di, Chigta Seyagi, Chigta Chakin, Chimbuchi Limosuni, Chigta Tutiachi. Suddenly, in the Zaning of Mikaroso Suda, Chikasu Repugate Tonachia, Sosu Interest Lines of Digital Remindu, and Kian Samolog, the Kumba Changshi. 당어서 결국 소수 미지 사실은 곧 차이하래. 어, 나 사실은 다 로지 재질을 되게 하래. 나 사실 다 야말래. 자, 근데 인도산에다 미 결국 소수다 미지지 기재 있는 것도 차이가 있으리샤. 당어서 대 지금 남주기 지금 상동다 사바지도 대 인도산에 다 된대기 선주디 다 들은 이슈. 저지버 좀도 마세베 드름슈 전이버 소소도 나로데 말레 투야시게 드레지게 타네 다 로빌리아 샴디 투야르지 이 쳬베게시게 말이 나다 미 동주 등주 삼올로 동게 메드버도 대한도 시다레 동게 먹고지 삼도 동다 자총자 미장 양보지 담어 들으셔다 디 제 강에 다 가서 삼신도 강에 속에 수지에요 말이 이제 소소 패버 중는 삼네 지들 지기 겜베 자야 삼고 다시 무슨 맵이 되잖아요 이제 지들디 패너 삼의 지들디 또 내버려 신도 돼야지 이건 되기도 와 저상 뒤에 있는데 괜찮아서 나 투시 투시 숨도 되나 투시 싸워 말해 가장 아주 컨셉트 다시 로드 하고 또 삼도 나지 이제 뭐다 뒤 아주 삼으로 지기 닝을 짱네 다 차다 참수 소소스 대전 뒤로 가와요네 어디서냐 두구로 시키다 시라나 세슈야 찍이
So what I wanted to share was that just few points. One is that initially when I first began engagement with scientists and science, the primary motivation was really driven by my personal curiosity. But as time went on, it became increasingly evident that there is actually some potential benefit that could be brought to the larger society. And for example, because of this, a new initiative for bringing science into the monastic education began, initially with a few hundred selected monk students, and then of course, over time, becoming more integrated into the curriculum. And on the part of the scientists too, it seems that as a result of our conversations and others, that perhaps one could say a kind of a new area of investigation seemed to have opened in the science, particularly in kind of, you know, what is known as the contemplative science, where a way of an attempt to understand how conscious mental training, such as meditation, can affect real change at the behavioral level. So there seems to be, and even for the scientist, a benefit, a real benefit in the way in which it opens up a new field of inquiry in science itself. So in this conversation, when we had the dialogue, you know, of course, each of us who have participated in the dialogue really enjoyed it. We felt stimulated. We will take something from this, but my own sense is that the purpose is not just that. You know, there is a greater purpose. And what we need to do is all of us to really kind of consciously reflect on this purpose. What is that collective purpose? And what is emerging here, and if I can be bold here, is to say that, you know, in this kind of conversation, in this kind of, you know, exchange, what we are proposing is actually a new way of thinking, a new way of looking at the problem. Because if you look at the needs and problems of the world, you know, I always say that many of the problems that we human beings face are actually problems created by ourselves. And if that is the case, then logically the solutions also lie in our own hands. But And there is also, if you look at the 7 billion people on this earth, there is not a single person who intentionally wishes to seek suffering and problem. You know, everybody wishes to be happy. Everybody wishes to overcome suffering. And, you know, driven by that motivation, we go about in our own, daily life. But of course, we, in the process, out of short-sightedness, out of ignorance, out of misunderstanding, we create the conditions of our own suffering. So this kind of work that we are presenting here is really proposing a kind of a new way of looking at these problems and taking the role of individual human beings seriously in the process of this developing solution for the human problems that we have ourselves created. And this is something that I feel is important, because otherwise, if it is only a matter of individual interest and individual benefit, then say, for example, I'm already in my 80, reached 80 years old, and my remaining years, is that not much left? So if it is only about ourselves, then it is very limited of its, benefit and purpose. But if we think about what we are doing as some connection with the needs and well-being of the larger humanity, then we are talking about generations. We can even envision the kind of work that we are doing moving forward into the 21st, 22nd century, 23rd century, and so on. And in this way, we could, offer possibly a way of looking at problems and way of dealing with problems where we really bring the insights through science and philosophy, including Buddhist science and Buddhist philosophy, into the service of larger humanity. We're not talking about propagating Buddhism. We're not talking about propagating religion. We're talking about an integrated way of dealing with problems and solve human problems. So everybody said here, thank you to me. Actually, you don't need to say thank you to me. Rather, you need to take these points at home and try to see in your own everyday life, in your own discipline, in your own community, what are the opportunities where you can bring this out and make it real.
If we really love Tang, then let the generation of 22nd century or 23rd century, let them remember our sort of certain work which we started, and it makes some because of the benefit through generations. So let them say thank.
Thank you.
Thank you. then usually I sort of telling or expressing the two generations, generation of 20th century, generation of 21st century. So we all belong 20th century. We are now walking towards end of our life because we belong to this century, gone. So now, you see, our real responsibility bring some new sort of concept, and it helped to develop holistic view, a generation of 21st century. Then they have the opportunity to create better, happier 21st century. Isn't it? This one thing. Then I want to mention, another thing. Now this time, you Indians, here. So all our knowledge come from India.
Tibetan knowledge.
Tibetan knowledge, Buddhist knowledge, come from India. So actually, all these concepts is India's ancient knowledge or kind of the thoughts.
Western knowledge.
Like that. So modern Indian, I usually used to describe modern Indian too much westernized. So a bit neglect about 1,000-year-old your own sort of real sort of the ancient tradition. These ancient tradition, time change. Some ancient tradition is out of date. Even better to forget. Some bad habit in this country still carry as a part of your traditions. caste system, because of dowry system, all this. I think now time come, you see, eventually should cease. But then some of these ancient sort of Indian sort of knowledge is not just ancient knowledge, but very relevant to today's world. These, you Indian, historically, our guru. So guru should take more, pay more attention about your own ancient knowledge, which is something relevant to today's world. So now this time, you see, you participated. I very, very, very sort of appreciate it. Thank you. Another point. Now forget. Stop now. Although we have no intention, you see, try to propagate Buddhism, Buddha Dharma. But when we discuss, you see, the Buddhist science or Buddhist philosophy, you see, there is some connection. So many of you, you see, mentioned dialogue between Buddhism and modern science. So I prefer, you see, Buddhist country like Japan or Thai, Burma, these, and eventually China and Taiwan. Now these, historically, their own traditional belief or religion is Buddhism. So I feel this is something more suitable. This kind of meeting, if possible, this is some Buddhist country. In the past, also I suggested. So that I want to share with you. So now, only my last wish is now quite a serious sort of flu. So scientists bring some method to stop this.